Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting email this week. He says, thank you for taking my email in question. My girlfriend and I listen to you on the radio, and she respects your opinion as I do. So here's the question. I've been separated for 9 months. I'm working on a divorce. Is it okay to date? I believe it is. But she's not comfortable with being around people who know my divorce is not final. Can you help? He kind of answered it.
When he said that, you know, his divorce wasn't final. You know what? I'm Carol the Coach. I'm Carol Jurgensen Sheets, and I'm here tonight to talk to you about what creates and makes healthy sexuality. And I'm here to talk to you about the opposite, which is sexual addiction. And I got to tell you, healthy sexuality is about knowing where you stand with somebody and wanting to connect with them in a very loving, spiritual, deep way. And that's very difficult. It's difficult to create when you're just hooking up with somebody for sexual pleasure. Now, you may be saying, hey, Carol, so you're against recreational sex. You know what? I don't think it's natural. I have no judgment for people that do it, but what I do believe to be true is that the people I work with, sex addicts, they can't do recreational sex. They can't do any kind of hookup. What they are looking for is to find true intimacy with somebody that they love. And let's face it, that in and of itself can be very difficult to ascertain. You know, I was talking with my group tonight, and I said, hey, guys, which came first? Do you think that you had an intimacy disorder that contributed to your sexual addiction, or did you have the sexual addiction that created the intimacy disorder? And invariably, they all said, oh, yeah, Carol, you know, what we know to be true is that we've all come from different backgrounds, but we also know that with our different backgrounds, we need a certain amount of consistency in our life. And that consistency comes with, and I kid you not, it comes with that development of a true relationship between a man and a woman. And I know that can be very, very tough. You know, I mean, in today's world, you're supposed to be 100% okay with, you know, whatever comes your way. However, I got to tell you that truly, what I know to be true is that people want connection. They don't want to just hook up. And when they get that connection, they know where they stand. They know what they need. And they feel better about the relationship. So, I so appreciate you listening to the show. Tonight, we have a really interesting guest. He is not your typical sexual addictions expert. However, a listener recommended him. And so I reached out and looked at his website, and he actually has a very unusual perspective on addiction. He is an addiction specialist, and I listened to his YouTube videos as well as I looked at his website, and he talks about addiction being twofold. You know, he says, you know, the ideas represented on my website are somewhat out of the mainstream, or perhaps better put, out of either of the two main currents of thought on the subject. The industry standard, as it were, is the notion of addiction as a disease. The other prominent line of thought is to the effect that addiction is a learned behavior that can be unlearned, an internal program that can be reprogrammed. So he says, if you look at my website, you can read an introductory overview of the distinctive perspective on addiction you'll find here. So he says, you know, what is addiction? And he further elaborates that while there are hundreds or even thousands of possible addictions, they can all be sorted into two forms, only one of which is my primary focus on this website. Here I will call them physical and existential. Now, he says both are widespread and inflict terrible damage on individuals, families, communities, and society. The physical form of addiction refers to a physiological dependency, while the existential form involves a devastating, intimate psychological and spiritual entanglement. So he's going to be talking about addiction from this perspective, and I think you'll find him to be very, very interesting. And, you know, he has really come to the plate. He actually had a root canal today and was willing to come on the show. I originally had him scheduled, and then I didn't hear from him. Well, he and I missed each other. I scheduled somebody else, and then she canceled, and I asked him, hey, would you be willing to come on? And he said, yeah, if I'm feeling okay, I will. So I really look forward to Roger Lockhart. And I know that he's going to give you a different perspective than perhaps what you're used to hearing. And that's what this show's all about. We hear different perspectives all the time and look forward to hearing what other people have to think. It makes for great information. It makes for great fodder. And gosh, I would never want to ascribe to just one belief. Now, I have to tell you, you all know that I've trained with Patrick Carnes, and I truly believe that his model, his theory of addiction, and the neurobiological impact of what addiction does to the brain and neural circuitry and neurobiology, I subscribe to that. But I'm always open to hearing what other people think. And, you know, more often than not, when I'm looking at theories, I like to combine my theories. And I like to take a little bit from what I believe to be true. And so that's what I think we're going to get tonight. And I'm looking forward to Roger talking about that. Now, what kind of issues are you dealing with this week? You know, I absolutely know that whether you are a sex addict, you're a loved one of a sex addict, or you're a partner, you have been through the ringer. And what I mean about that is that, you know, addiction is so very difficult, and it is devastating. It absolutely devastates lives, families, communities, individuals. And I think the show is here to help you. I don't want you to feel bad about yourself. That's what shame's all about. And that is probably not going to get you to do your best work. And what I mean about best work is that clearly I want you to be motivated to change. And when somebody feels depressed and inadequate, when they feel like there's nobody lower on the earth than them, they typically don't work. So what I want you to believe about yourself is that you are a work in progress, and you can make a difference in your own life and in the lives of others. And you've heard me say it hundreds and hundreds of times before. I truly believe that when you work a recovery program, when you do that hard work, you end up being a better person than the average man or woman. And when you are better than the average man or woman, then more than likely you have found a purpose and a passion. You know, I was talking to a guy tonight, and he works in an area that is very heavily laden with strip clubs. And he said, you know, Carol, I want to start an SAA meeting so badly. I want to start it, and I want to make a difference in my community. So he has gotten together with one other person, somebody that SAA in Indianapolis said, hey, there's this guy in his city. So he got a hold of him, and interestingly enough, they started a meeting. They're going to be on the roster for meetings, and they're going to be on the website, the national website, within an actual month. And here's what I believe about SAA and SA. Build it, and they will come. This is an epidemic, and so whenever you put together meetings, you know, I was talking with another guy who said, yeah, about 10 years ago, I started a meeting and I was all by my lonesome for about 3 months. And it happens to be one of the biggest meetings that there is right now. And, you know, how gratifying to put in the time to have the belief and the patience to say, you know what? I know there's a need out there, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to be available to the community. The 12-step program is available to help everyone who has an issue, who wants to make a difference. And, you know, I can't say enough about that. That's what it's all about. So, do you feel like you have a purpose and a passion? Can you make a difference in the lives of others? Well, I know if you're in the depths of your addiction right now, you don't feel like you can. But my promise to you is absolutely you can. Get yourself healthy. Work some real recovery. Do what it takes to do the work. Now, the work is not just going to an occasional meeting or reading an occasional book. The work is working it. And I know it can feel like, oh, my gosh, you're abandoning your family, because I've got a guy right now who is really, really struggling, and he is now attending 90 meetings in 90 days. What a commitment. And in his 90 meetings in 90 days, he is also going to be calling one person from the fellowship every single day. That in and of itself is a lot of work. He already has a sponsor, but he hasn't been calling him enough. He He already has attended meetings, but he hasn't been going to enough. He has not been contacting the fellowship. He has been working the steps, but intermittently. So what he's doing is he's refocusing his entire lifestyle on five things. He's going to attend 90 meetings in 90 days at SAA. He's going to meet with his mentor, which is his sponsor, once a week. He's going to work the 12 steps. He's going to call people in the fellowship, and he's going to read the Green Book. Okay, that's the first five things he's going to do. Then what he's going to be doing is he's going to do some praying and some meditating and some journaling and some recovery reading. He's going to work on healthy behaviors, and he's going to make his life work. And when you follow those 10 tools, you're much more likely to make your life happen. And that is just one prescription for how to handle addiction. And there are many, many more, and that's why I'm so excited to be talking to Roger, because he's going to be talking about what is addiction and what does he see as the avenue to making your life different. So, Roger, welcome to the show. Welcome to Sex Help
Thank
with Carol,
you, Carol.
Coach. Yes. How
Thank
are you feeling tonight?
Well, I'm feeling fine, happily.
Oh, fantastic.
As you know, Pardon?
Yes, I know you went through that root canal, and that was at 9
right.
o'clock this morning.
That's right.
And here you are on the show. And, you know, I told you that one of my listeners to the show had recommended you. He loved your YouTube videos, and so he said, Carol, you've got to see this man. I think he'd be a great asset to the show because he talks about addiction from somewhat of a different perspective. So can you tell me a little bit about your philosophy on addiction?
Well, I can tell you about what might be sort of an entry point into my philosophy. The common and very understandable tendency for those of us in the addictions community, whether it's treatment or addicts themselves or the frequent crossover of the two,
mm-hmm.
is to talk about addiction and think about addiction as though it were the enemy, an enemy,
mm-hmm.
To the point where, for example, it's commonplace to hear people say things like, my addiction is trying to kill me. And I know where those things come from, and I'm sympathetic to the sentiment and the concern that prompts people to want to be very on guard, because the addictive consciousness within us is very wily and very determined, and is always available to fill in the hole if we lapse in taking care of ourselves. But it's not because it wishes us harm. It's really quite the opposite. The way I understand addiction is that a certain part of ourselves gets recruited to the idea that we will be best off, we will have the most profoundly gratifying experience of ourselves and of ourselves in the world, in the universe, in our connections and endeavors and so forth, if we can enlist some kind of a control methodology to bring about that transformed experience of self. And in the case of every addiction, there is an initial liftoff, if you will, when the person, the addict, right now we'll just keep it to people, although I do, as you may be aware, I do also recognize that larger systems, families, communities, and even nation states are subject to addiction as well. But keeping
Absolutely.
It simple for the moment. So that initial experience, which often but not always is pretty abrupt, you know, the literature and listening to people speak at meetings. Again and again, we hear people talk about how essentially their experience of life was transformed when they first used X, whatever X might be. It might be a chemical, it might be a behavior, etc. And from my point of view, the fact that we turn and follow the invitation that X gives us is not the result of us being bad, crazy, stupid, or sick. Rather, it comes out of the fact that we're human beings who are filled with longing, and when something comes along that says, oh, I can give you fulfillment of that longing to a degree that you've never even experienced before, naturally, we come back for seconds. So that's how I understand.
Yeah, that sounds so enticing, doesn't it? And so if I understand correctly, you're saying that...
Well, and it is. It is enticing. And there's, on the face of it... I'm sorry?
I was going to say, would you say that we give that notion of addiction way too much power?
Well, I don't know that we have all that much choice in how much power we give it, because when it first presents itself, it's as authoritative as any experience we've ever had, and indeed more authoritative than most. I'm trying to think of a quote by Rainer Marie Rilke, and he says, my blood is alive with, I think it might be yearning, that tells me I am made of longing. These longings, I think, are the most essential component of who we are. And so when something comes along and says, I can bring you fulfillment, it is eminently reasonable that we follow it. The fact that it turns out to be the beginning of a downhill descent into the most, ultimately, the most demeaning and degrading and diminishing and, disintegrating experiences of ourselves. We don't have a way of knowing that because the positive experience is so compelling and so authoritative that we say, well, yes, those bad things that happen to some other people who become addicts, they won't happen to me because I'll just stay on the lookout. And if it starts to get bad, then, of course, I'll change. But
so now, you know, obviously you've been doing work in the field of addictions for a long time. So when did you first look at addictions from this perspective? How long ago, and what actually shifted you from the mainstream, if you will, definition of addiction?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Carol, because I came into thinking keenly and usefully about addiction when I embarked on my own sobriety journey, and that was 1973. And I started working in the field in 1979. But even in the very beginning, in 1973, I spent 19 days at one of the old-fashioned drunk farms. And there wasn't a lot of talk about disease, Carol. It hadn't lifted off. There's a... You probably are familiar with Ernest Kurtz, who wrote the book Not God.
Absolutely.
If you're not familiar with it,
I am familiar with it. You're going to recommend it.
Absolutely. Well, he wrote an essay, a lengthy essay. Perhaps I can put my hands on it, examining the history of the disease construct, or as I put it in my writings, the disease label, because with all due respect, and I mean that earnestly, often that's said as a, you know, kind of a softening the pad before decking somebody. But I say quite earnestly, with all due respect, the efforts to make the disease construct proposition into a adequate and successful model have not been all that successful. But setting that aside for a moment, number one, as I said, the disease component or the disease aspect of conversation was very occasional and sort of in passing in 1973 when I was at the drunk farm. And as you're probably familiar with in the AA big book, I think the word disease maybe once, and there's a few times when they talk about illness, but for the most part, there's it's worth noticing, for example, that in the 12 steps, not only do they not talk about disease, they don't talk about alcohol. The steps, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous mention the word alcohol exactly once, which is in the first half of the first step, where it says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. And it turns out that's the only thing we need to know about alcohol. And the rest of the steps don't talk about alcohol, don't talk about drinking, don't talk about alcoholism. They talk about a path to, remember how I was saying earlier that the addiction enters into our lives through a transformative event?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the case of sobriety, sobriety enters into our lives through a transformative process. And the distinction between event and process is very germane here because, although it's not always true for a great many addicts, it feels like an aha moment, like a kind of an epiphany. It's like, oh my God, where have I been all these years or months or whatever it may be? This is so wonderful, and it fixes everything right away. Whereas when we embark on sobriety, although we may have some pink cloud periods of time where it feels like everything is all better, down the road we discover that there is a journey that we've embarked on, and it is by no means a stroll in the park every step of the way. But the work that we invest on behalf undertaking that journey of investing in that transformation turns out to be more than worth it. One of the things that I say, Carol, when I do trainings is, and it's kind of interesting because I can see how some people in the room will sort of flinch when I come to the last three words. I say, if you're going to have credibility with addicts, when you're working with addicts as a clinician or as a helper, you need to be able to say and know that it's true that sobriety has payoffs to offer which are at least as good as the addiction did. And now here comes the three words. At its best.
And okay, so now that you say that one more time, in that sobriety has, what I heard
sobriety
you say, that sobriety has
offers
chaos.
Sobriety
has the
offers
same,
chaos.
Has an amount of chaos.
No. No wonder you want to repeat. I was not saying chaos. I was saying payoffs. P-A-Y-O-F-F-S. Yes.
Okay.
God knows it has plenty of chaos as well. No,
but you know, when you said that, I just was talking to a man today, and he is just doing incredible, incredible work. And his wife just came up to him and said, you know, I really think that you need to take an offender's assessment. And it just threw him into that spiral of shame, and he's done such great recovery, and he's really working a program, and it was chaotic. So I'm glad to hear you say that it's payoff. Now, you know, you said, if I understand you correctly, that part of real recovery is the transformation. And
that's from my point of view, that's the essential component.
Journey, because obviously you had significant addiction, and so transformative event that helped to catapult you into the shift.
Into the shift?
Mm-hmm.
What was a transformative event or the transformative event?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think I can put it quite simply, and that was hitting bottom. And like a great many of us, suicide seemed like a reasonable option, but in all honesty, I wasn't suicidal. I just couldn't see any path to a life that could work for me, because I had tried living drinking, and I had tried living without drinking, dry drunk, and they had both become abysmal. And so I went to the drunk farm by default, because a friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine, took me there and made all the arrangements. And over the course of 19 days, pretty much everything turned around in a very fortunate sense. But
absolutely.
Now,
you keep calling it the drunk farm, and I'm wondering, because I'm wondering if that's your own terminology for a rehab hospital, or if that is something, in the 70s that they called hospitals.
Well, in 1973, there was very, very little happening in terms of rehab hospitals. The field had not been dignified to any significant extent. The ignorance about addiction in general, alcoholism in particular, was rampant. And pretty much anybody who would put up a shingle that says, I can work with drunks, would be inundated, whether they were effective or not, frankly. But this particular place, which was called High Watch Farm in Kent, Connecticut, was founded by Bill W.
Mm-hmm.
back in 1941. And when I say drunk farm, it's not even faintly disrespectful or disparaging.
Right.
On the contrary, it's kind of keeping in spirit with the very unpretentious, unprepossessing and
the humility that goes along with true recovery.
Well, it was that, and it was also, nobody there had a degree. There was nobody there who was an official trained counselor. Everybody there, from the director down to the breakfast cook, was a sober addict, pretty much all sober alcoholics back then, with some, multi-drug use, but everybody was at least alcoholic. And they understood very clearly and explicitly that you were as likely to hear what you needed from the breakfast cook as you were from the director. And indeed, I heard some wonderful stuff from the breakfast cook and the groundskeeper.
And so then you got out of the drunk farm, if you will, and did you go about living a life that was not specifically geared around addiction? I mean, you did your own thing for a while?
Well, did I what?
So I'm curious as to when did you make it your purpose and passion to help people understand addiction from your point of view?
Well, what I mean, quite honestly, and I don't think even a little bit uniquely, I think it was probably 10 or 12 days into my stay at High Watch that I began to toy with the idea of being a counselor.
Okay.
And through some sorts that was not my own cleverness or wisdom, it dawned on me that I would probably be well advised to learn it before I proposed to teach it. So from some intuitive source that I can't pin down, the thought came to me, 5 years. If I can put together 5 years of uninterrupted sobriety and I still find that I have an inclination, a draw toward that kind of a vocation, then okay. And every once in a while in the ensuing 5 years, I would have a job change and the thought would come to me, well, maybe I should be an alcoholism counselor. But I'd, you know, count the months and years, and it wasn't 5 years yet. And then one time it was. It was 5.5 years. And I put together a resume, and a few months later I got hired to work at the Detox in Springfield, Massachusetts. And I've been in that field ever since. That was March of 1979.
And then when did you make it your mission to educate people about your perspective on addiction? Because it is different from that medical model or that disease mm-hmm. concept.
Well, you know, it feels, Carol, like my perspective and the gradual preponderance, that's not quite the word that I want, comprehensiveness, the thoroughness of the disease language, vocabulary, and of course treatment options and facilities and so forth, that my perspective as being distinct from that has grown in parallel. And it's been informed by watching that. But what I meant to say earlier, and I'm glad you brought me back to it, is that while I was at High Watch, on those occasions when the disease language was presented to us, I made kind of a mental note. It's like, gee, that doesn't work. Well, here's the thing, Carol. I had no difficulty appreciating that I had become diseased. No doubt about that at all, and that I had become diseased because of my alcoholism, because of my addiction. But there wasn't anything in my history, my memory, or my intuition when I listened to the teachings that were so vital for me. There wasn't anything that said, oh, I had this compelling experience with alcohol because I'm diseased. Because I was diseased. That just didn't work for me. I had the, as I put it in many of my writings, I had that experience because I'm a human being, and to put it in fanciful but very authentic language for me, I'm a human being searching for God. And that experience, the first night that I got drunk at age 16 under the first full moon of summer in a graveyard in Iowa, that experience was as close as I felt to God for about the next 16 years. And it was so compelling, so comprehensively rewarding, and rewarding is not, I don't like that word. Fulfilling again is, people frequently talk about filling that empty space, but it was much better than that. It was feeling filled with a gracious kind of power, a graceful kind of power, freedom, a connectedness both with the people around me, with the world around me and inside myself, and of being held in the palm of the universe, if you will. And at that time, I was 16 and youthful enthusiasm for rejecting spirituality and religion. But it didn't matter. That was a deeply spiritual experience. And that.
Now, let me ask you something, because clearly one of the I've been trained by Patrick Carnes, who is the founder of sexual addiction, and that is
right,
a process
addiction. I went through a training
of his. Different than a substance addiction. And yet, we really believe that the theories behind any addictions are basically the same. They create some of the same dysfunction in the neural pathways, and they light up the reward center. How much do you look at brain science as you look at addiction?
I don't look at it at all.
Okay.
I don't look at it at all for essential guidance, Carol. I look at it because ever since I can remember, I've been fascinated by science, and I think science is way cool. And I think when I was a kid, I thought I was going to grow up to be a scientist, and that didn't happen to be my path. But what I have observed, and literally in the first few months after I left High Watch back in 1973, ever since then I've kept note, and there hasn't passed a year that there haven't been two or three, quote, breakthroughs that were going to lead to some kind of a scientific grasp of addiction, whether it was alcoholism or more broadly addiction, that would allow scientists to cure, control, manage the alcoholism. And number one, that hasn't panned out, in my opinion. But number two, it's barking up the wrong tree. It's proposing.
And it's barking up the wrong tree because?
Because it's proposing to resolve a predicament that is founded on the error of control through more control. Every addiction basically presents us with what seems like a magic solution to the problem, what I call the problem of self. How can I be the self I most want to be? And, you know, the magic potion comes along and says, here, all you have to do is masturbate or drink this or eat that or exercise like this or whatever. And you can control, you can manage your experience of self. And so that's why when and if we encounter the 12 steps, we discover that the very first thing they're telling us to do in the first three steps is to get it clear that control is not the solution. Control is actually the problem. And so we're urged to recognize that, as many people have said, the first step is basically, I'm not God. The second step is, however, there is one. And the third one is, I think I'll turn to God. And so we've fundamentally reoriented ourselves. Just earlier tonight, on the back of the pages of your format for the show, as I was mulling it over, I found myself jotting down this notion. Willingness is when we connect with God. Willfulness is when we become God.
And interesting. Willingness, we connect to God, and willfulness
is when we connect
when
with
we believe
God.
We're God.
Willingness is, well, I put become God, but you've certainly caught the essence of it there. Yeah. So those things, those fundamental propositions, I mean, the master, the sort of the Zen master of AA in many respects, I think, was Dr. Bob, who, of course, is known for his deathbed words, "Keep it simple." But he was also known for a brilliant summation of the 12 steps in 6 words. And I'm sure you've heard these. Those words are trust God, clean house, help others.
Mm-hmm. And so for
amazing.
People who may be listening who have not heard that, they're new to the 12-step program, explain
mm-hmm.
how that process works.
Well, let me first say just a little bit about how it doesn't work.
Okay.
What I mean by that is I often say that there are only 2 categories of error that we can make in doing the work of sobriety. And you might notice that I use the word sobriety instead of recovery, and I don't mind explaining why, but I won't interrupt it right now.
Okay.
So the 2 categories of error are, number one, of course, to not do it, to neglect to do it. And it is possible to go to, 5 meetings a week, very dutifully, and still not actually be doing the work. And the second error, and I have to say both of these errors are honest and essentially earnest mistakes, but they are mistakes. The second error is to imagine that the work of sobriety is about following the right set of rules. And that's a deadly mistake, because following the rules is simply embracing an alternative control mode. It's not a casual twist of language that had the founders of AA insist that the steps and the slogans and so forth are suggested, not rules to be followed on pain of death or whatever. And that's not just a humble nicety. It's a recognition, in my understanding, it's a recognition that, as I often say, the worst enemy of sobriety is compliance. Now, that's a little dramatic in its statement, but I want to drive the point home. You know, if you came to my office, you'd see a poster on the door greeting you before you even touch the knob. And it's the poster from the book by Maurice Sendak, Where the Wild Things Are.
Absolutely.
It has these you know that, right? Everybody recognizes that. I actually had a wonderful conversation with Sendak one evening for about a half hour about that. But in any case, I basically want to make it clear right from the beginning that what we're doing here is not learning how to be good boys and girls. What we're doing here is we're learning how to be the most real, authentic, richly fulfilled, striving, seeking creatures, adventurous, and so forth, that we can possibly be. And I think a lot of people find that both surprising and encouraging.
You know, I think anybody who is listening to you tonight knows that you're a very deep thinker and you don't take anything for granted. And it is that curiosity, I believe, that helps to solidify a sense of confidence in what's working for you. And so I want people to know how they can see you on YouTube and how they can view your website. So
mm-hmm.
give them that information. How can they, first of all, catch your YouTube videos?
Well, that's wonderfully simple, and that's simply to go to YouTube and then type in my name. My name is not quite so simple. It's the first name is Roger, and that's people who are familiar. I don't know how many people use a thesaurus anymore, but when I was a young man. Roget's Thesaurus was a common reference work. That's R-O-G-E-T. And then my last name also gets a little confused because people want to put in extraneous H's and T's. But the actual spelling of my last name is L-O-C-K-A-R-D, as in David. So you just type those names in separate, Roget Lockhart, and you will be introduced to what is so far, I believe, 8 episodes of an ongoing series of interviews that I did a couple years ago with a man named K.C. Scott on his show, Come to Think of It. And we had a grand time, being very reflective, just like you and I are tonight, Carol. But we had, this was on television, of course. It was on a cable channel out of Greenfield, Massachusetts. And we stretched it over a couple of years, of just meeting once a month or thereabouts and exploring these ideas a half-hour chunk at a time. And my website is also, you can, this is with no space between the words. You can just type my name, rogerlockhart.com, and that'll take you there. I have to warn you.
Excellent. Absolutely excellent. And so how did you get to interview? How did that happen where you were on TV and interviewed this man about addiction?
No, he interviewed me.
Well, he interviewed you. How did he interview you?
Why did he interview me? Well, here's the thing. I started working in this area in Western Massachusetts in 1979, and for the first 7 years, I was in detox settings, first in Springfield and then about the other half of the time in Greenfield. And as you, of course, appreciate, detox is a high-volume business. And so at one point I realized that I had worked with over 20,000 different individuals who had come through those facilities. And then I went on to be the director of family treatment at a outpatient clinic and a general clinician, both at Greenfield and in Northampton, Massachusetts. And so it was in 1987 that I started seeing clients in a private practice and gradually segued into full-time doing that. But by then, a lot of people knew me. And I had also, like a lot of people, I think, working in the field, I had belatedly gone back to school and gotten a graduate degree and so forth. So in the course of that schooling work, that was a lot of networking too. So for one thing, there was a lot of exposure. My ideas were well received. But also, as I mentioned earlier, the truth is people are so distraught and so tearing their hair out at the ravages of addiction that seem to be getting only worse. And I think that's a correct perception that, frankly, you don't have to be very good. All you have to be is persuasive and confident, or at least appear to be confident, to get people coming to your door. I don't know how long they'd keep coming if you weren't actually being helpful, but there's an urgent market for people who can be helpful with addiction.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, and obviously you have made it your mission to put out there your beliefs about AA and about addiction, and it's very, very empowering. So, Roger, I want to thank you so much, because it is true that, especially in the world of sexual addiction, it's a brand new field. You know, although sexual addiction's been around for a long time, the internet has really escalated things. And we use 12-step programs to combat this. And it's nice to hear you really endorse the 12 steps. As you look at addiction from just a little different perspective, most addictionologists. So I thank you so much, and I encourage anybody, again, to go to your website or to look at your YouTube videos, because they are fascinating. And again, you can access his website by going to R-O-J-E-T. And let me make sure I got this right. L-O-C-K-A-R-D.
That's R-O-G.
Yes.
R-O-G is in George. R-O-G-E-T.
Yes. And that's pronounced Roger, right?
It is. I thought you said R-O-J because some people put a J in there instead of the G, trying to approximate the phonetics of it.
So
you've got
it. I appreciate
thank you so much for the
what you're doing.
Thank
I
you for
really
the invitation,
do. And I do feel like there is a certain confidence that you exude as you talk about, you know, people need to check out AA, and before they go to a meeting, they should know about the rules. And at the same time, the illuminating feature, as you say on your website, is that in the 12 steps of AA, the word alcohol is mentioned only once. So people really can apply any compulsion that they feel to this program and follow the steps.
Let me
and
be clear about one.
The shame.
Let me be
I mean,
clear about
for
one.
You, what you saying is that it doesn't necessarily have to bring about shame. There is that transformative event of, you know, kind of being at your rock bottom.
Right. But let me back up and be very clear about one thing. When you quoted that segment of my saying that I tell people that I want them to be very clear about the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And what I say to them then is, there aren't any.
Right. Absolutely. And that's where you're way different than the average addictionologist. And so,
well, you know, Bill W.
People that are opposed to rules, that, you know, for a lot of people, that instills kind of an opposition to an entire program because they aren't rule followers. They don't want rules like that. I really encourage you to look at Roger's website because it will allow you to breathe easier into what this program is all about, knowing that even though people present it as being filled with rules, it really isn't at all. Do you agree with that?
Presented as what?
Even though people present AA as you need to follow these rules, you got to do these 12 steps and you do
it.
No. B, C, and D. And it's not like that at all.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing, Carol. You're exactly right. It's not about following the rules. And at the same time, as Bill mentions in the big book, what we have is we have a mortal predicament that if we don't find our way to integrity and to having not an obedient relationship with the principles of the fellowship, but an authentic reception. You know, there's a slogan in the fellowship, H-O-W, how do we get sober?
Mm-hmm.
And it's an acronym, I'm sure you're familiar with it. And the H stands for honesty, the O for open-mindedness, and the W for willingness. So if we have that, then it no longer becomes an issue of are we following the rules or not. It's are we earnestly doing the best that we can to follow the principles that we believe in, that we embrace, and that we subscribe to.
Oh, amen. I agree with that wholeheartedly. Thank you again for sharing your wisdom. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Carol.
Okay, take care of that root canal.
Yes, I will.
All right, have a great
week. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Uh-huh. Bye. So So that, again, is a man who obviously has made it his mission from the mid-70s to work through his own issues around alcoholism and to look at life and at the 12 steps and at recovery from a different perspective than many of our addictionologists. And thanks to our listener who recommended Roger, this is your show too. If there's somebody you want me to interview, put it out there, and I will do that. And as I say at every show, you know, there will only be one of you at all times. Fearlessly have the courage to be yourself and know that we are a community working together to really combat any kind of compulsion and to enable serenity to be a part of our lives. You have a great week, and I will see you next Monday night for more Sex Help with Carol the Coach.